and welcome to Roots, Today's Sustainability Scene, a podcast produced by journalism students at Mount Royal University in Calgary. This series is powered by Shaw and a part of the Community Podcast Initiative here at Mount Royal. Roots is based on the Sustainability Forum organized by Mauricio Lutapi, a professor in the Bissett School of Business at MRU. The event featured 20 presentations examining sustainability from a range of perspectives. The series explores sustainability in interviews with the people who gave those presentations and the forum organizers.
I'm Mimi Young.
And I'm Riley Stang.
And in today's episode, we will be using our platforms to engage in discussions that move us towards a more sustainable future. Recently, I was given the opportunity to sit down with the academic vice dean in the Faculty of Business and Communication Studies here at Mount Royal University to chat a bit about education from a sustainability perspective. Mr. Cave was one of the expert speakers at MRU's 2023 Sustainability Forum, Connecting Research and Practice. Here's what he had to say. So, Dr. Cave, what do you do here at Mount Royal University?
At Mount Royal, I'm the Vice Dean Academic for the Faculty of Business and Communication Studies. So I look after curriculum, programming, student integrity issues, and help sort of guide the direction and part of the leadership team here at the in business and in comm studies.
All right, at the forum, what sort of things did you touch on with regards to education and sustainability and the academia?
So I've done a little bit of research in the area of environmentally responsible management and corporate social responsibility. I've worked in sales and marketing, and you know, my doctorate's in international business, so it's a lot of ethical sourcing and those kind of areas. But you know, that's sort of a sustainability perspective. The other side of it is I love education methodology. Like, what really sticks? How do we transfer knowledge? How do we get people to really jump in and engage with topics and concepts? So Mauricio Lutapi, who ran the forum, sent me the question. He's, you know, talk about sustainability in education. And I'm like, okay, that's an immensely broad topic. So I think maybe the question was supposed to be education sustainability, but I didn't take it that way. I ran with, here's what sustainability means, right? We talk about environmental, economic, you know, social sustainability. And those three tenets are really, really important. But then how do we layer that into education, especially at the post-secondary level? And how does that connect? And that was essentially the crux of my presentation.
So advancements or innovative ways that we can make sustainability engaging inside the classroom.
Ooh, now that's a good question, right? How do we make it engaging inside the classroom? We also have to decide, right, if we want to make sustainability, we can do one-offs, and we do that quite a bit, right? In the business school, there's a course in sustainability. There's a course in corporate social responsibility. It's not a required course. It's, you know, people that are already interested in it will take that, right? And so that's where a lot of, you know, fun case studies and analyses of sustainability practices take place. But I'll step back a little bit further as I answer your question by saying education is the pursuit of knowledge. And so I think that if we really want sustainability, if we really want to make it engaging and enjoyable, it needs to be the pursuit of students within those classes to determine what it means, how it works, where it lies, right? But really, if sustainability, and I always say if, because, you know, people need to make that decision. We're often told sustainability is very important. Well, okay, are we going to act on it? So if we bring it back to education, we say, okay, so we want to engage in it, right? What do students think it means? And are we giving them the bandwidth or the opportunity to explore that? Because what I think is sustainability is not necessarily the same thing that you think is sustainability. So let's explore what works, what doesn't work, why doesn't it work, and where do we want to go? That's not a course. That's education.
I like that answer.
Oh, it was really nice. Thank you.
I think I get what you're throwing down. That's good.
Okay.
All right. So for future leaders in business and communications, mm-hmm. how do you think
they can be ethical going into how do future leaders here at Mount Royal become ethical leaders?
Wow. How do you become an ethical leader? And again, I'll go back to it's the pursuit of knowledge. So it's not a transaction. It's not a structured delivery of a program. It's about discovery, right? It's about trying to figure out what's out there. We already know what we know. And we can give that to students. And students can say, yes, okay, that's great. That's what we know. That's the base. That's not where we need to go. Where we need to go is, what can we do next, right? And so I see that very often, and part of the challenge is that we'll get stuck on an idea or a moment in time, and then we'll just go, well, that could never work, right? So I'm often minded of the electric vehicles, right? Like this, and you look at it and go, okay, well, it's more expensive than using fossil fuels. Okay, right now. But that's, you know, everything that we've looked at, every improvement we've made has been initially more expensive. But over time, it's increased productivity. It's allowed for benefits that, you know, benefits to society and consumers, et cetera, depending on how you look at it. There was somebody on TV, it was this morning or yesterday, who said, well, if we all had electric vehicles right now, it would destroy the electric grid. I'm like, well, yeah, but it's not magic. And if we start increasing our purchasing of electric vehicles, the response to that is an increasing in our electrical capacity, an increase in our electrical availability. You know, like all those things are intertwined. You can't take one piece and go, well, look at this. If we do this, then it's all no good, right? Like the ability to pull lithium out is difficult and extremely expensive. It is, because right now we're at the very beginning stages of doing that, right? When we move from wood to coal, like we had the same issue. Like, oh, it's so expensive and difficult to get coal. Yeah, it was. We kind of figured that one out, right? So, you know, for me, when you're looking at leadership and you're looking at ethics, right, don't necessarily grab those big topics and say climate change, right? Like, oh, climate change is terrible. Yes, agreed. But what are we going to do? Like, what are the steps we can look at? How do we move people towards that? Because if you choose a massive idea like the guy on TV saying, well, if we all had electric vehicles right now, okay, well, that's not reality, right? We need to move towards where we want to go. So ethical leadership or sustainability is all about taking the steps to be able to take the next step to get towards your goal. But your goal isn't immediate. And it's those kind of things, right? So I think, stick with that.
You're right. It's just, you know, bite-sized pieces. Mm-hmm. And when you were at the Sustainability Forum, what were some of the more exciting advancements that you see being implemented into this concept?
What are the more exciting advancements? I mean, some of them are based on my own background and the fact that I've spent a few years in supply chain. Right. And so we talk about reverse logistics and the circular economy. Right. And so they're fairly new. And reverse logistics has become a really big issue as we buy more and more online. The more that you buy online, the more gets returned. And so this is a fascinating concept, especially when we talk about fashion. Right. So because fashion is a good example of how this doesn't work. Right. And so what actually happens? So you get online, you buy it, you're like, oh, this is awesome. It's going to look great on me. You order it, right? You order, let's say, five pieces. You decide that two of them just aren't for you. You send them back. Well, where do they go and who picks up that cost? And quite often, depending on who you're talking to and what story you get, is that they'll either say, just keep them and give them away. So the company has lost that value. Or they'll say, yeah, send them back. And those go directly into the garbage or an incinerator because you can't really resell them, right? It's very difficult. You know, you've taken them, we've sent them to you, you've tried them on, you've sent them back. For a company to turn around and resell it becomes now a little bit of an ethical issue and, you know, potentially. So very often that just gets eaten by the companies. So there's a really big focus of also, who bears that cost of return? So most places you'll see, if you're buying online, will say, you know, we have a no-cost refund return policy. You send it back, we will pay, we'll send you the barcodes or whatever, you stick them on, away you go. So it's no cost to you, the consumer. This is good. We use this as our buying decision. But the companies are paying for that. So now your price of goods has to go up to be able to cover that. And then we could suggest that somewhere in the range of 30 to 40% of goods are being returned. So now that's a massive amount. So almost one out of two, right? Or two out of five is the example that I was using, right? Like, that's a massive amount of returns. So what are companies doing? Now they're finding lower cost labor, you know, lower materials, and trying to adjust while also maintaining a profit margin that allows for this return policy to work. And then eating the cost of bringing these things back. So, you know, supply chains worked a lot on that, trying to figure this out, because it, you know, there are still some companies out there that will send it to you and say, yeah, you know what? You don't like it? Fine, keep it. Here's your money. Okay, now you got a free shirt that you don't like. Okay, cool. So you re-gift it, I guess. Maybe that's okay, right? But it still doesn't really help. In fact, what it does is it increases our consumption rates. You still want a shirt. So now you got that refund, you probably buy another shirt. There you go, right? And so increasing our consumption rates is not something sustainability really talks about, right? We talk about being a little bit more intentional in our purchases and things like that. But I like what I like, right? And I want more, right? It is sort of the mentality. And then, so we get into circular economy. And so the circular economy is, you know, the reuse of goods or the reuse of materials and how it all sort of, you know, goes in a circle to the idea of, like, Apple's really worked on this, trying to get you to return your phone so that it can pull pieces out of your phone to use in new phones. It's not perfect, but, you know, there's an attempt there to try to use this so that it's not just going straight into the oceans or landfill or being burned and released into the atmosphere, right? Like, which is where this stuff goes, right? So...
Right. Yeah. I always think about, I'm pretty sure I've ordered a few things off of Amazon where I'm like, this has definitely been used. This is not new. It's not even, is that what my Prime membership is? It's all free. Let me expedite this junk to you in 2 days. She won't even notice before she gets her buyer's remorse.
It can be quite risky. For companies to do that, right? And so because all you do is you got one star, right, and a comment that becomes public, and then people don't buy it, right? So my daughter has a retainer. I ordered a retainer cleaning kit, supposed to have a package, and then, well, I sort of missed the point of what we ordered, right? So now I have some choices, right, as a consumer, right? Just speaking to that example, right, is that I can get on Amazon, give them one star and say, this is terrible. Oh my goodness, right? Now, you go through the return policy at Amazon, which is very simple, or they say, just keep it. So if we're talking sustainability, and there's so many different pieces that we're not necessarily connecting, and I think this is a little bit of a flaw in education and the way that we do this, is consumer decision is based on this. Right? Consumption patterns are based on this. Sustainability says, whoa, those things need to be less important. How does that work? How do you get people to go, yeah, you're right, I will pay more? You can, but it's very challenging.
Yeah, I definitely think everyone needs to ask themselves, what part are we playing in our dissatisfaction, and what can we do? Yeah, like, how can we think about it?
Right, and I think it's a conversation that's been missing, right? Is that we don't talk about value, and I think you're right. We gotta look at all those pieces, and we often like to say, it's always somebody else needs to do this, right? And I think we need to take responsibility and make these choices based on what we value, but we're not actually talking about what we value. We're talking about trying to force people into decisions.
Yeah. Thank you so much for being a part of this conversation.
Well, thank you. It was my pleasure. I enjoyed this. I'll have to do it again.
Sounds good. All right. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
That was Dr. Adam Cave from the Faculty of Business and Communication Studies on sustainability from an education perspective. Now let's hear from Riley and Meg Wilcox.
I spoke with Meg Wilcox, a professor in Mount Royal University's Communication Department. Meg is also the co-director of the Community Podcast Initiative. Listen along as we discover how podcasting is paving the way for a sustainable future in media. Meg also gives us an insider look into a podcast she's contributing to. Keep listening for the full story. Can you tell me about your passion for podcasting and where it began?
Well, I think for me, it didn't start as podcasting. It was audio storytelling. And for me, it was growing up listening to the radio, really, with my family. My dad is a painter, a teacher. He teaches painting as well. Many of my childhood memories are being in the studio with him while he's doing these big, gorgeous landscape paintings and listening to CBC radio. So I listened to the radio from a young age, and I'd be, you know, scribbling with my crayons or whatever, you know, as he was doing his stuff. Road trips and hearing audio storytelling, and then when I got to journalism school, I had an idea I wanted to work in radio, but I can't say I knew enough about radio. I just had this feeling that when I got into the class, I would love it. And that was kind of what happened for me. And I think for me, it's the ability to tell stories and use other people's voices as they say it. So, you know, I would take the writing course and I'd be interviewing someone and I'd think, oh, like what a pain it is to take the transcript and the quotes that they've given and put it in writing when it was always so much better and sounded so much more real and more interesting in my ears when you hear it from their voice.
Now, you're the co-director of the Community Podcast Initiative. What does that role include?
To be honest, Brad Clark and I are still figuring that out. We're both the co-directors. So, you know, the Community Podcast Initiative is totally new, and we haven't had a program like this at the university or with the School of Journalism before. So right now, it means that we're kind of the caretakers, I guess we could say, of the space. The studio that we're in now, I helped build and design and sort of oversaw the renovations with that with the university. It's also about figuring out programming that we want to do, right, like training opportunities for students. Are we going to bring in podcasters and residents who could be here or around to be able to help train and tell stories and work with different groups? So we're still figuring out entirely what that means, but I guess it also means we answer the emails that people send us about the CPI.
When many people think of sustainability, they're not considering media. Why do you think podcasting is a sustainable path for the future of journalism?
Yeah, I would agree. And to be honest, I don't even think I'd thought too much about podcasting and sustainability until I was invited to speak at the forum. And I thought, well, a lot of our work ties to sustainability and environment. My work with the Canadian Mountain Podcast, for example. But realistically, I don't think I always thought of it that way either until I started thinking about different definitions of sustainability. And like you've mentioned here, the idea of sustainability of news, right? The one thing that I really do think, I mean, I don't think it's a surprise to anyone when people talk about a crisis of journalism. And it's not that journalism is bad, it's that there's a lack of trust in journalists. And I think we have to stop and think about where that trust, why it's being lost, right? And I don't think we have full answers yet. I think part of it, though, is the old ways of telling stories, of having, you know, this old man in a suit and tie on the television looking at you, telling you what is the news, doesn't really ring true for us anymore, right? When we have so many other ways of getting stories and so many more natural ways of communicating and sharing with people, right? I think about the popularity of TikTok, right? The idea of talking straight to a camera or dancing in front of a camera or having fun with something is something that's really connecting with people right now and how we tell stories. And so I see podcasting as a way of helping bridge that gap, you know, how I talked about audio storytelling and how I love hearing it from voices. I think we tend to trust people we can hear from in a natural and conversational way more. And I also think that as, you know, consumers of news, we care about the process with how stories are told. We want to hear about how the story is told. And older ways of news would just be, you know, you go get your interviews, you cut up your clips, you write your piece, and you put together what your 2-minute piece, sort of giving it as an authoritative view of how that story or how that story ran out that day. But podcasting gives us a chance, and I think of all like the true crime podcasts, right, to actually say, so here I am, I have this problem, and this is how I'm going to try to solve it. These are the people I'm going to talk to. I'm going to share with you my questions and my processes. I figure out my answer, and I'm going to share that with you. And I think that's what people really respond to in podcasting, is that, you know, I'm more likely to believe your answer if I can actually see how you came to it, how you made those decisions. That's the kind of thing that I think people really like and might bring a bit more transparency back to news.
So like you just mentioned, journalism really began as a colonial practice. Can you give me a few examples of how podcasting challenges traditional news?
Super colonial, I think that's the official term, probably. When we literally think that the history of news was, you know, Europeans or like white men or Brits like going off to other countries or other places to report on what they see from their perspective, take it back to their home countries, right? Podcasting challenges traditional news in a variety of ways. So one of them is, as I mentioned, is that being able to speak, I think, more colloquially, not the, you know, conversationally, being able to work with anecdote and personality a bit, not being able or not being tied to traditional timelines, right? Like a newscast would be 30 minutes and it cuts out at the end. You have to keep to certain times and things. Whereas podcasts, we can make them as long or as short as we want. You can release them whenever you want. You can create that own that your own I guess we could say rules and let your audience know how you're going to put it out there. The other thing that I think podcasting does differently is that we can just access it all over the place now, like with smartphones, with being able to have, you know, internet or Wi-Fi in our cars or accessing that stuff. We can now, you know, get our news and information on the go. We don't necessarily have to be rooted to one location. And I think that changes how we see it too.
Now, what barriers do you think podcasting still has that, if solved, would make it a more sustainable option?
Oh, there's so many barriers. So I think one of the first barriers, and this is sort of going against the assumption that a lot of people will often say is, oh, anyone can podcast. And you think, well, okay, in theory, we don't have gatekeepers. Like, you know, I'm thinking about media outlets or, you know, do you have a radio license to have broadcast radio, right? Which is what you would have needed before podcasting. But not everyone can podcast, right? First off, you do need the gear. And while it's not super expensive, you need to be able to access the gear. You need access to the internet. You need to understand enough how to, like, upload and work within that stuff and time to make it happen. But I think one of the other things that we really need to consider is just because you have the technology doesn't mean that you're necessarily going out there and doing it. And we think about the voices we normally hear, even in podcasts, much of the top 10 podcasts, right, are still typically male and white. We're hearing more women hosting now, and we do have more non-English content as well that's starting to change, but still, you know, it is a US-centric or North American-centric world in podcasting and English podcasting, even though I'm trying to remember the stat, but I think they only make up, like, realistically, a portion of the audiences that listen to podcasts, a small, like, I want to say 5% or something. I'd have to double check that stat. So that's part of it, right? Is why is everything still being North American centric when there's all these other stories and voices and people that maybe aren't choosing to share their stories? And I think that gets to something bigger, right? That just because you have a microphone doesn't mean you necessarily want to put it in front of your mouth and talk. And so what are maybe some of the assumptions around producing audio or podcasts or stories or publishing that have certain groups maybe not wanting to yet or certain people not wanting to? Is it an issue of skill set? Maybe. Is it an issue of confidence? Perhaps. Are there other potential reasons why people aren't doing it? And that's something that hasn't really been looked at yet in terms of, you know, scholarship and research. But I think that's really one of the big barriers we need to consider. Of course, we also think about the digital divide, right? If you're living in Northern Canada, is your internet good enough to consider, you know, some of these uploads or bigger files or streaming or doing those types of things? From a technical perspective, it can be challenging even if you are putting together a podcast.
Now, I want to ask you a couple questions about podcast creation. Something you brought up during your discussion is how podcast sources sometimes review questions prior to their interview. This almost never occurs in traditional journalism. So why do podcasters choose to do this?
Yeah, and I wouldn't say this is a traditional way of doing podcasts right now, but it is a way that with my group of students, as we're working on the Canadian Mountain podcast, that we do. And so part of this, just for context, because I'm sure most people haven't heard of the Mountain podcast yet, is this is a series that's been going on for about 5 seasons where we interview people about Canadian mountain research. So we work with Indigenous experts as well as researchers. And the idea is that we get to bring in these different types of knowledge in a conversation together around these different projects. So part of what we were looking at in this is saying, how do we work with Indigenous knowledge holders who have traditionally been misrepresented in the media, right? Or not represented, but when represented, often misrepresented. And this comes back to that idea of what does it mean when outsiders from far away come in and ask you questions and decide on what the story is and not talk to you before it gets published? It's more likely going to be inaccurate, right? And that's where it gets tricky, because I think by traditional journalism standards, it would be said, oh, well, that's biased. You can't let your source decide what your story should be. Otherwise, it's not accurate. But I think we also have to understand that as journalists, we have the opportunity, in a bad way, I'd say, to mess up the story, right? So part of what we decided to do was to share our questions ahead of time. And part of that is to make sure that we're helping build back trust with our Indigenous experts who are normally kind of weary of the media because they've been misrepresented in some way, shape, or form. But part of it is also to make sure that we're accurate, because the thing about being journalists is that we very rarely go into a story where we would be an expert in it, right? We interview the experts. So why would we assume that we have the best questions to ask? The experts probably can point us in the better direction and correct things if we need to. And so that's part of the reason that we do that. We go about that. Now, this doesn't mean, like, never has a guest come in and said, don't ask this question. They would normally phrase it as instead, oh, I might ask it this way, or this is what you want to get to. Obviously, it's a little different when we do accountability interviews. You know, if I'm talking to a politician and they're like, oh, don't ask me about that thing I messed up. Like, yeah, we're going to ask, right? But it's finding that balance between what is the goal of our interview. And if the goal is understanding and the goal is being accurate, the goal is sharing knowledge, then I don't see any reason why we can't share our cue lines ahead of time to make sure that we're actually doing that properly.
I'm glad you brought up that podcast. The Canadian Mountain Podcast has a unique approach to land acknowledgements. Can you tell us about how they're being created?
Yeah, so the thing with the Mountain Podcast, you know, in as I've already explained, you know, we're doing research around mountains, we're bringing Indigenous voices in, having these conversations, it made sense to create a land acknowledgement. Now, the challenge with land acknowledgements is that we often know them based on, like, events, right? Like at the start of a meeting, or if you're at a hockey game now, and those types of things. We tie them to being physically in a room together. And also, they sometimes go a little bit longer than we would use in audio, right? We always like an audio to shorten things up, make it a little bit snappier, like faster than it would be in real life. And then the other problem that we have with podcasts is that where is here? Like, you and I are here in a room right now. We have a shared location, right? But someone listening to this podcast could be halfway around the world. And so what does here mean? What does land mean? And how do we connect that? And for the Mountain Podcast, we normally interview people remotely in all sorts of parts of the country. So we could actually be, you know, based here, like at MRU. They could be maybe up north, and someone could be listening to this series from Norway. So it can be all over the place. So we start thinking, well, what does land actually mean? It's easier when you're all in a room at a meeting and doing a land acknowledgement. So we decided to look at land in a few different ways. And so one of them is right off the top of the show. You can hear a land acknowledgement that speaks specifically to where we're producing, but the people of the land here, right? So thinking about, you know, who have been the traditional stewards in this area, why is it important that we recognize them, and sort of the roots of that history. But then the other thing we do is that when we start interviews, after asking someone their name and their title and how to spell it, and how we would always do in journalism, we now ask a guest to say, well, tell me about where you're from. Tell me about your connection to where you're from. And this gives the person the opportunity to talk about the land they're from, their connection to it, why it's important to them, and also to help us as, you know, interviewers understand where they're coming from. So we can create a sense of place in the first part of the land acknowledgement from us as producers. The second part is our guests getting to talk about where they're from and why it's important to them. And then we have a third one at the end, which is a bit more traditional and just pointing out where it's produced and also where our commitment lies. So when we think about land acknowledgements, the best ones are pretty personal. It doesn't sound like you've just taken something off of an organizational website and you read it, right? And also we want it to be situated to the environment and the conversation we're having. And so We want there to be some sort of commitment. And we're not saying everyone's going to solve reconciliation, right? But, you know, if we think about the land where we're on, the people who have stewarded it, what they've provided, that has provided us where we are here now, what can we commit to make things better? You know, for me as a settler, in terms of settler-Indigenous relations or making things better for Indigenous people in this area. So we think a bit about, like, what can that commitment be? And that's where we have our commitment in our podcast. And it, in our case, it's to be able to listen, to learn, and to work on continuing to engage respectfully and responsibly with Indigenous stories. So we're not saying we're going to solve everything, but we're saying that we're going to make an effort. We're going to continue to try to strengthen those relationships through listening and learning, and that we are going to do our best to continue that tradition in the work that we do. So it's kind of a three-parter. We sort of spread it out throughout the episode. And part of that is how we get around the audio stuff too, so it doesn't feel too long when you're listening to it.
That was Meg Wilcox of Mount Royal University. Thank you for listening to Roots, today's sustainability scene.
I'm Mimi O.
And I'm Riley Stang. The series is powered by Shaw and a part of the Community Podcast Initiative here at Mount Royal University.
It was produced on the lands of the Nitsitapi Blackfoot, Iyahe Nakoda, and Tsuut'ina and Métis peoples. We recognize the stewards of these lands and the knowledge that they bring to our understanding of sustainability.
A special thanks to Mauricio Lutapi, who organized MRU's Sustainability Forum. He has been so supportive in helping us put this series together.
Be sure to subscribe to the show to hear the latest episodes and to discover new podcasts from the Community Podcast Initiative on our website, thepodcaststudio.ca.